Welcome to the Star Trek Retrospective by Film Strip Podcast.
My friends, we've come home.
Our host will boldly follow the voyages and crews of the Starship Enterprise.
It is not logical.
These podcasts will be spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the Star Trek movies.
Neither believe nor doubt.
Now, on with our show.
Make it so.
Welcome back to the Star Trek Retrospective by Film Strip Podcast. I'm Jay.
I'm Nate.
And today we're talking about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, starring William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, George Takei, Walter Koenig, Nichelle Nichols, and Catherine Hicks. Written by Harv Bennett, Leonard Nimoy, Steve Meerson, and Peter Kreix. Directed by Leonard Nimoy. Released in November of 1986 on a $26 million budget. Got a little bump in that this time. Grossed $133 million at the box office. So, Nate, after being really serious in the first movie, hard sci-fi, and then being dramatically serious the last two movies, they decided to come back with a lighter touch this time. And I feel like, and everything that I've read verifies this, that Nimoy really wanted to do something that was not as, you know, dramatically tense and action-y, but to do something kind of fun, because he's a big comedy guy. He's directed a lot of comedies. He's into comedy. And he felt like this group of people could do comedy, even unintentionally. And that's an interesting choice to make after having two incredibly successful sequels in the series.
That's true. I mean, they were very, very successful, but I mean, they are also looking at like, okay, we got to do something different, because Star Trek can't just be remembered for this. Like, I mean, it was action packed, but it was dark. Three was, I would say, even darker.
Yeah.
And just macabre in a lot of ways. I mean, you've lost the Enterprise. Kirk's lost his son. I mean, we're seeing it, everything at their like worst. And Leonard Nimoy was like, okay, we really shouldn't keep venturing into this route. We need to kind of, let's lighten this up a little bit. And it was the 20th anniversary of the beginning of Star Trek. So they wanted something a little bit lighter to kind of celebrate those 20 years.
Because it was really smart too for Paramount and everybody, Harv Bennett, you know, the producing crew and everybody behind this, to go, we cannot miss the 20th anniversary year. We have to hit that. And this is later in the year. So this was like a Christmas movie almost. It's a holiday time. And yeah, it was the production schedule of this. It took them a long time to get it, you know, together and to do it all. But they wanted to get out in that year. And it's a good thing that they did, because some of the franchises that I've followed through the years have made anniversaries, and some have missed them. Like Bond has missed a couple of big ones because they can't get their stuff together. And, you know, and that's a whole other day. it's been years reviewing that series. But
oh, yeah.
But yeah. But Star Trek, you know, at this point, again, Paramount now saw this was a viable product again. We were getting into the age where people had access to home video in a way that they didn't have before. We weren't quite at the sell through point yet, because Batman 89 really broke the glass on that, but we were getting into a place where collectors editions of VHS tapes were coming out. So the original series you could get at this point, and then the other movies were obviously out on VHS, and home rental was a big deal though, because people were renting movies. And so they knew, hey, people are going to rent Wrath of Khan. They're going to rent Search for Spock. They're going to know that we're coming back. And if we hit them with the right marketing campaign, it'll really drive people in. And, you know, I went back and watched one of the trailers of this, because I went and saw this with my whole family in the theater. I think even my grandmother went, and she wasn't even a Trek fan at all. But we all went to this because of the trailers. So we're like, they're going back to the 80s. This is going to be hilarious. And it is on the heels of, I think, arguably the most successful time travel movie of the 20th century, Back to the Future. And there's nothing in the background stuff that I could find, but I kind of feel like that had to play a little bit into the idea here. But I wanted to ask you, time travel in the Trek universe, had they explored that at all in the original series?
They did. They did three separate times. There was what a lot of people would consider one of the greatest Star Trek episodes ever written across all series was The City on the Edge of Forever, where they went back to 1930s United States, 1930s New York, And in that, up for those who don't know, Kirk and Spock go back and they're stuck there for a time. And they had to, Kirk ends up saving this woman from getting hit by a car, but because she's saved, she eventually convinces FDR to not get into World War II, which then leads the Nazi Germany winning World War II and then altering, you know, the history of the future, you know, the, you know, Earth's history. So he has another chance. He has to like let her die. And it's killing because he got to know the woman and everything like that. And they fell in love. And then he has to like let her die. So that was a powerful episode. Journey to Babel was another one. And one of the other ones was, I forget the name of it, where they go back to the 60s. It was the one Journey to Babel, I think, is the one where there's one where they go back to World War II. And then there was another one where they go to first one that was contemporaneous to the time of the show. They go back to the late 60s and they encounter a U.S. Air Force pilot. And so that was pretty cool. The remastered version of that episode, by the way, is phenomenal. But so they had explored that. And it's interesting because there's an episode of Deep Space Nine where Sisko goes back in time, but he's visited. The episode begins where they're visited by the agents from like the temporal crimes for the Federation. And they mention Kirk. He's like, oh my God, that guy was a menace. He violated the, you know, time codes all over the place. So this was an interesting, so doing the time travel job is something that Roddenberry had wanted for a while. Mm-hmm. And one thing I will say, I think one of the biggest, there were many reasons why I decided to do time travel and to go to, again, contemporaneous times, 1986, just like they did in the episode where they went back to the 1968, is that one, it was to save costs. So they didn't have to build these big sets. But number two, this, and I will say this, this may be one of the only times throughout all of Star Trek history where this actually worked. Not the only time, but one of the only times, is where they wanted to make a movie for non-Trek fans. They wanted this to appeal to people outside the Star Trek fandom. Yeah. And if there's something that makes me, as a Trekkie, if there's something that makes me cringe to no end, is when a Star Trek series or a Star Trek movie says, oh, we're writing this to appeal to the non-fans. And 9 times out of 10, it doesn't get the new fans in, and it angers the hardcore fans. So you don't get any fans. You don't get any audience. I mean, they tried to do that with Discovery. They tried to do that with the first season of Enterprise. They've tried to do that with the second season of Picard. I mean, and in all those instances failed. Now, the reboot in 2009, which we'll get to in a future podcast, it worked. Like that was, but they also appealed, like, we're going to make a film that's for non-Trek fans, but we're going to make, we want these hardcore fans, Trekkies, to also like it as well. So they, I think they did that well. So this is the one of the only times where they're like, let's make a Trek film for Trek fans, but let's also appeal to non-Trek fans. And it worked.
Yeah. And I quoted Back to the Future there, or cited it as being one of the influences of this. And I think it plays in the same idea, is that you don't have to really understand the sciences around the time travel stuff. We're just going to give you some rules, and there's a mission. So Back to the Future, obviously, you know, the very specific thing they're trying to do. And in this one, they come up with let's take the thing that made V'ger kind of menacing, but let's not lean into its origin or why it's doing. Let's just make it the thing, the MacGuffin of the episode here. And let's also talk about something that we care about, and particularly Nimoy cared about a lot, was the environmental aspect of it. And I know Harv Bennett was involved in that, and that's where Mearson and Crikes came in too. And they said, well, you know what, let's talk about something that we can actually affect that won't bother everybody. Because at this point in the 1980s, environmental awareness was one of those topics that, like, it wasn't talked about the way we talk about it now in, you know, 2024, where it's just everyday parlance, right? Because we didn't know what we know now. I mean, it's been 40 years. And we didn't have a good way of messaging that throughout schools or anything else. No one really understood. So they said, how can we get people involved in this? Well, let's take a creature that doesn't do any damage to anything, but has been hunted to the point of extinction, and let's make those the thing that we've got to go save, rather than being people we have to go save. We have to save all the people. We'll save the whole world. And we will also save a species that there's no way anybody's going to root against, right? Like no right. one's going to go like, nah, F them whales. You know, no one's going to feel like that. And so it's smart choices though. And I hear you as the fan going like, oh gosh, when you try to appeal to the non-fans, you can miss everybody. And that's very true. As a wrestling fan, I see sometimes the promotion try to do that when they're trying to get the casuals in. And the ones that do it well know how to play that out. And there's tons of stuff for the, you know, the ones that are always invested. And then there's things that also bring the casual in too. And it's a hard balance. It's not an easy thing to do as a writer and as performers, but comedy is a great inside for that.
Yes.
Particularly fish out of water comedy, right?
Yes.
Let's take people and put them in a situation they're not comfortable with. And the jokes write themselves. Like, what would it be like? And it's the same thing. Like Marty McFly didn't know how to operate 30 years before his time. Imagine 3 centuries.
Yeah. And this, it's also, I will also say there was this perfect storm that led to this popularity among the casual fans. So you had, it was a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It was set in 1986. So people was like, oh yeah, this is what it would be like if these famed future characters come back to our time. It was also really leaning into the Save the Whales movement at the time, which is very popular. And tragically speaking, there was also you also had the Challenger explosion that happened earlier that year. So this is like really the first Star Trek movie the first science fiction movie that looked at science fiction after the Challenger. So you had all of this coming together, which I think it really brought all these people together into this movie. And something, speaking about the whaling part, a lot of people don't know this, but this was the first Star Trek film shown in the Soviet Union.
Hmm.
And it was shown because they had just earlier that year put a ban on whaling for the Soviet Union. And so that was the first Trek film, and some of them went over to the Soviet Union for the screening.
Oh, that's pretty neat. I remembered the Challenger thing because anybody that grew up in that time, like we did, that's just one of those. I knew where I was when that happened, was watching it, you know, and got to see it. And that, I can't explain to people that are a good bit younger than us that have only maybe seen the documentaries about it and things like that, to know what an impact that had on America. Because at that point we had gotten so bored with the space shuttle missions and stuff that NASA was doing anything they could to try to keep public interest up and government interest up. So they put a school teacher on the thing, and everyone following Christa McAuliffe that's why they were watching that whole launch. And when that thing exploded, I mean, you just talk about just devastating a nation. You know, I mean, it was National Days of Mourning. I mean, I remember being in school, and it was, we just took time out of everything to talk about this. Yep. And then to have this major franchise recognize that and put it in the opening credit and all of that stuff, that it was just one of these moments that's like, everybody needed to kind of feel good about things again. And, you know, if in a future we get to the place where we have Star Trek level space travel, the people that literally died to get us there need to be recognized. And so you have a lot of touch points for an audience to get into. And not only American, I mean, that was an international story, you know, because America had won the space race for sure. And at that point. And so it was a big deal when the Challenger exploded. So, yeah, that's good to reference and remind people that was also a driving force behind. We need to do something to give everybody a good lift and a little bit of hope.
Yeah. And it was, you know, imagine had this been another like really dark, really dark and depressing film as 2 and 3, and they were honoring the Challenger. It'd be like a reminder. It's like, oh, that was also sad, but this is a comedy. It was,
yeah,
yes, it was great to honor them, but it was also like, yes, it was inspirational.
Mm-hmm.
This movie's inspirational. The Challenger's inspirational. It's like, it was a reminder. It's like, yes, space is still an inspiration to a lot of people, instead of like, oh, it could also be sad and depressing, just like Star Trek 3.
Exactly. Yeah. And we'll get more into that in just a little bit, but let me throw through the plot summary here, Nate, and then we will talk about the movie in our formula. So for anybody maybe joining for the first time on the retrospective, because of the subject matter, I thought, hey, let's use technology to help do this. So according to Gemini from Google, here's the plot summary for Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home. Kirk and his crew are exiled on Vulcan after their daring mission to save Spock. However, their peace is shattered when a mysterious alien probe appears in Earth's orbit. The probe emits a strange signal that disrupts all of Earth's technology and everything in its wake and creates environmental havoc. Desperate to save their home planet, Kirk and his crew, aboard their stolen Klingon ship, decide to hurtle back through time. Through a series of deductions, Spock realizes the probe signal is a call for help, but in a language no longer understood, and he identifies the source, humpback whales, which are extinct in the 23rd century, but thrived, or at least somewhat thrived, on Earth in the 20th century. The crew arrives in San Francisco 1986, fish out of water experience for all of our futuristic heroes. They must blend in with the time period while acquiring key information to save Earth and a pair of humpback whales. Kirk and Spock encounter a marine biologist, Dr. Jillian Taylor, who becomes their reluctant ally. The crew faces a lot of challenges getting the whales, dealing with 20th century technology, and avoiding attracting too much attention. Meanwhile, they scramble to repair their ship and establish communication with the whales. Hilarity ensues as the crew tries to navigate the quirks of the past, from nuclear power to fast food. And in the climax, the crew transports the whales to the future using a makeshift tank aboard their cloak ship. And with Dr. Taylor's help, the whales respond to the probe's call, calming it and saving the Earth. Kirk and his crew face the consequences of their time travel and their previous actions and are ultimately pardoned for their bravery, except for Kirk, who is demoted from admiral back to captain. And the film concludes with a bittersweet goodbye between Kirk and Dr. Taylor. And Kirk and the crew are taken to their new ship, not the Excelsior, but the new Enterprise 1701A, as credits roll. And that is our plot summary. Lots going on in this one, for sure. And I think, again, it's fun to pick up where we are here on Vulcan with the bird of prey that they've named the Bounty. I think that's Dr. McCoy's idea, because the mutiny that went about, and they all are voting on what are we going to do next, because we can either go on the run or we can go back and face the music, and they all vote, let's go back and see where the chips fall. And Spock's alive. He's with his people. We know he's okay. They don't even expect him to go with them. And so we got two things going on. We got Kirk and the crew deciding what to do, and then Spock going through his tests and his trials. And the one thing he has no grasp for yet is the human part of his emotions.
So, yeah. So it's interesting starting off on Vulcan, and just like between 2 and 3, it picked, like, 3 picked up right at the end of 2. Well, 4 picks up right at the end of 3. So here they are, they're on Vulcan, Spock's back, the struggle is real. He's the last of the characters you really see, and then he's just watching as everybody's getting the Klingon ship ready, and Scotty says, it's taken some time. It's like, you know, getting everything running is easy, reading Klingon, that's hard.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge getting the ship ready. What else are we going to do? You know, are we going to go on the run? But all the years they've dedicated, all the things they've done, as Kirk once mentions in one of the films, like, we've given our bid for king and country. They realize that, you know, that would be kind of bad for everything we've done and everything we've contributed to Starfleet, that to just run away. Let's all go back. Spock, I love, as he's just sitting there watching and he's taking that test to get his brain sharp again. And you can see he's still just like rattling off all this history. He's playing chess while at the same time answering philosophical questions on this test. I mean, his brain is as sharp as ever until that last question. How do you feel?
Yeah.
And the computer constantly, how do you feel? How do you feel? And he's just like, I don't understand the question. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and thus begins that understanding of where, like, he just came back from this amazing experience, and he's still trying to reconcile what's going on upstairs.
Yeah. And the thing is, and we'll see that in some great banter with him and DeForest Kelly, by the way. So talk about just good unintentional comedy, two that have always played off each other. They're rivals, but they're friends. And McCoy's trying to get him to go, like, come on, you can't tell me anything what it's like to come back from the end of, you know, death or whatever. Spock doesn't process things on the emotional level yet, or at least he's not able to at this point, and he can't give him anything. And McCoy's just so frustrated with him, like, okay. Well,
that was one of my favorite lines, where McCoy's like, dude, your head was in my head, and he's trying to say all this stuff to him. He's like, well, what I'm saying is, like, you may have been in my head, but I can't feel your shoes. And Spock is like, my shoes?
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't understand the metaphor. Like, that's what's so good about it is, instead, a lazier movie would have just had him back and he's in uniform and everything's good to go, right? And we just jump to the next adventure. The fact that they decide, no, we're going to linger on this for one more chapter. We're gonna let it breathe, and it's going to provide the part of the comedy that we'll need to get to, but it's also going to give us good plot point because Spock is in his like super logical state. He's going to be able to navigate and operate in the out of time phase easier than the other ones because they're emotionally reacting to everything that's different for what they know about history and life. Whereas Spock just looks at it as another mission challenge thing to do, you know, and it never dawned on me before that was part of the plot devices here until watching it this time. And I was like, well, this really smart scripting here. And usually we get four people writing on a script, man. That means like there's 25 people that wrote on it. And that's a problem. Yeah. Right. But in this case, I think everyone is bringing in the right amount of balance and elements. And from what I understand, Nimoy was the one to really keep everything on the level and make sure that the characters, their motivations and their actions didn't change just because they were in a different scenario, that everybody kind of got a moment. Cause we talked about before in the other ones, it's hard to give a big, you know, ensemble cast, everybody to have a minute, right? Mm-hmm. To have a thing. Well, everybody gets a mission, and wisely they chose this time, we're going to split everybody into teams because it makes it easier to navigate. And I was like, that is wise. That's what you do in an ensemble, is everybody has a job. You know,
of the six original series films, this is the one that had the absolute best ensemble acting. You got to see everybody got to play a role, and everybody had something. It was fantastic. I absolutely loved it. But before we leave Vulcan, before we get off the Vulcan and get onto the mission, one thing I'd like to point out, this is the last appearance of Savick.
Yeah,
Savick was supposed to be somebody ongoing. Savick, as we'll talk about later, was originally going to be in Star Trek 6. But this was Savick's, you know, she stayed behind on Vulcan, and a lot of people speculated, well, that doesn't make sense. Like, she wasn't part of the mutiny, but why is she staying on Vulcan? What is her mission? Like, she was rescued. Obviously, she's got to go back and debrief with Starfleet. Why is she just not hitch a ride and go back with them? And it was originally written that she was going to stay behind with Spock's child. Yeah. And as we talked about in the last podcast with Star Trek III, the burning of the Vulcan blood, the Ponfar, there's only one way to stop that.
Yep.
There's only one way. And let's just say that it would have been impossible for Savick not to have Spock's kid. That, and I mean, we're talking, this was 1986 when this came in. We still haven't addressed that in any series. Like, Spock's got to have a kid out there. Come on.
Yeah. They never will. They'll never touch it. I think at some point they realize we cannot go there, and we're just not going to. But I'm with you. It's one of those that I hate that we lose that character. But on the other hand, because I've already said that they do the great job of balancing out the cast this time, there would have been nothing for her to do. She would have been in the way in a lot of ways. Yeah. And we're going to gain a character here. One that I'm sad we never get to talk to again. We'll talk about Catherine Hicks in a little bit because she had a hell of a 1986, and then we'll talk about that. But yeah, I was really, really, I've forgotten that Savick walks away from us and we never go back to her again. And I'm with you. I remember the behind the scenes stuff that she was supposed to come back for 6. And when we get to that one, I'll talk about whether or not that would have worked better than what we get, but yeah, it is the end of Savick. So what do you make though of the probe and its destructive effects? And do you agree with me that it reads a little bit like V'ger's revenge?
Oh, it does. Because this is something that's just, it doesn't realize what it's doing. It just has one mission. In the original script, it was written that they were going to have subtitles, like the alien probe, once it got to Earth, it was going to have subtitles of what it was actually saying. It was just going to be one question. Huh. Where are you? That's it. That was the only thing. Where are you? Over and over again.
And that would have been good, by the way.
That would have been really good. It's just I think that would have added, I mean, Leonard Nimoy elected in the end not to have that. Mm-hmm. But imagine if that would have been, I think that would have added it better. It's like, what do you mean? Who, where, who, what? Mm-hmm. But I like that they finally had an quote unquote antagonist, not really an antagonist, but that wasn't just bent on somebody's destruction.
Yeah.
And this was just like, okay, this is a very Trek thing. We have to figure out how to stop this thing. It reminded me a cross between V'ger and the Doomsday machine in the original series, whereas the Doomsday machine, it was just programmed to do what it did. It had no emotion. It had no vengeance or anything. It was just set out to do this one thing, just like this probe, and it didn't realize what it was doing.
And it interrupts a hearing, if you will, going on at Starfleet Command with the Federation president. You've got the representative from the Klingons who are, you know, we want Kirk brought to justice. He killed some of our people. This is an act of war. And then you have Sarek, Spock's father, walk in and really just Perry Mason him right into the ground. I mean, it's some good. I mean, it's like, man, I didn't know you were a lawyer too. It was good. It was just like, you have the right to commit murder, and he just goes on him. I'm like, wow, that's, and I love though that they don't let that stuff slide. Mm-hmm. Again, a lazier screenplay, a lazier series would have just been like, yeah, that all happened, but now we're going to do this other problem. It's all connected. It's what we said, you know, 2, 3, and 4, this loose trilogy, not even loose trilogy. They are a trilogy of films and they're all very connected to each other. And I like that. I like that we're hanging on to those things because again, this is at a time when we didn't have ready access to just watch these whenever you want, you know, so you had to, if you were a fan and you had kept up with this stuff, like you had, and other deep fans had, you remember like, oh, they're not going to let that go. Cool. And I really appreciate that efficiency in the screenplay to do that.
Well, that trial, that what was going on with the Klingons and everything like that is also sort of, because you got to remember, just the next year, The Next Generation was released.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Next Generation, the Federation and Klingons are at peace. So the line, like, there will be no peace as long as Kirk lives, it's, I think, in a way, sort of foreshadowing what eventually will come is a peace between the Federation and the Klingons. Mm-hmm. And they knew this. They wanted to kind of like, hey, we want to, you know, kind of hint at that a little bit. We'll see this obviously in a couple of movies, but I love that. And then suddenly the probe comes and they can't leave. They can't escape Earth. One thing I did notice is as the probe arrives and you've got all the storms and nobody can leave and power's going in and out. And as they're talking about like how it's affecting different cities on Earth, one of the cities that's mentioned is Leningrad.
Yeah.
Which is no longer around. So interesting. In the 23rd century, apparently it gets renamed to Leningrad.
Yeah. No. Well, you know, we just swap names around every now and then, you know, we were talking about that, on a recent review once. We called a country. We're like, isn't that called something else now? I'm like, I don't know. It's in the movie. It's called this. That's what we're going with. So, but I did like that. But you know, the other thing they're dropping here too, is that the Klingons are hinting at the fact that their way of life is disappearing. Their planet is dying. There's things going on. They're going to come back to that in a few movies. But this was also the thinking at the end of the 80s was that it was obvious that the Russian state was falling apart. We weren't very far from Chernobyl, and that really was kind of the last straw that broke the hold of the party and things like that.
Yeah, Chernobyl's that earlier that year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, all these things are happening. And I feel like, again, that they're making a nod to the simple logic has always been like, well, the Klingons are like the Russians, you know, even though they're a little more complicated than that, there's more nuance to it. But in simple parlance, that's what they are. And they have a right to live their life too. But, you know, you can't kill people to do it is the whole point of the Federation. And the idea that in this somewhat, I wouldn't even say utopian future, and just in this future where there's a lot more expansion, if you know that there's more than just your planet out there, it's got to change your perspective on things. As that, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to get over our earthly problems, and then we're still going to have the same ones intergalactically, but we're going to solve them the same way through good diplomacy, but also by being firm. And, you know, well, yeah, I hear you, but you still can't demand just life for life. We don't live in that world anymore. And so all of that, of course, is interrupted by the probe. And, you know, we've got Kirk and company trying to head back to town, and they see everything that's going on, and they see this, you know, these ships are getting wrecked and these space stations are falling apart and all this stuff is going on. They're intercepting these distress calls and are trying to figure out what to do. And as they're trying to get that last word in, like, okay, what can we do here? They come up with the plan to, we're going to travel back in time. And like we talked about before, that's something they've done before. They even referenced it. Like, we've done it before, you know? And so again, if you're a fan of the series, you know, these things, and I'm glad you reminded me that I remember the one about the 1960s. I remember that episode. The other two I didn't know about. I'm going to go dig those up now though, because that sounds really, really intriguing. Particularly the FDR one, because that feels like something I would watch on Cody's Alternate History Hub on YouTube. Cheap plug, by the way. If you're into alternate history, which I am, I like some of that stuff. That's always fun to kind of go down the rabbit hole. I want to go check that out. But I love that they come up with this whole sequence for it, and they're going to just sling around the sun. And I love that it's like 1.21 gigawatts. Don't ask too many questions. It's going to work.
Yeah. Like, we've done it before. We've got this. Spock has got all the computations. You don't need to go deep dive. Just trust. And a lot of it's like, just trust Spock. Like, he says, I've got this figured out. Just trust me. I've got it. You don't have to go deep dive and how, and, you know, is it going to be successful? It was, it's exactly it. But just real quick before we get to the time travel part, if I can, about the probe, two things to mention. One, the design of the probe was patterned after Arthur C. Clarke's Rama and the Journey to Rama series. It was patterned, same like cylindrical kind of traveling through space kind of thing, coming to Earth. And two, the sound effect. Do you know about the sound effect for the probe? It's actually, they were trying to make all these sound effects, and Leonard Nimoy is like, no, it's not what I want it to sound like. And that finally the sound effects guy's like, well, what do you want it to sound like? And Leonard Nimoy says, wub, wub, wub. So they brought Leonard Nimoy into the recording studio, recording him doing wub, wub, wub for 2 minutes, and then added sound effects to blend that in with, like, it's a mix of like whale sounds, Leonard Nimoy's wub, 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 and some other electronics. And that's where they got the sound.
Oh, that's awesome. No, I didn't know that. I love good Foley work like that, though, man. When people just come up with the most random stuff and they're like, well, we'll just take a little baby beep and we'll just, you put some reverb on it. And back in those days, we got to remind everybody, you're doing that with tape.
Yes.
You're not doing that with computers.
You got to get around the first try or you got to go back. Yeah.
Which leads into my next piece. And cause I have to know, and maybe you don't, which of the Trek group are big Pink Floyd fans, and tell me why Leonard Nimoy's one, because this time sequence thing is a friggin' Pink Floyd video. And at this point, Floyd hated each other to the point that they weren't working anymore. But I'm sitting there going, like, I could find at least six Floyd songs that this could be set to right now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know which Trek group is into the Pink Floyd, but I agree. Like, it was very Pink Floyd design as they're going back in time. Very trippy. That was very, even as a kid, I'm like, what's going on here?
I don't know that I got all the claymation and then the naked man falling through the atmosphere and into the primordial,
that was cool.
And I mean, I remember sitting in the theater going, huh? And at this point, I hadn't seen 2001 yet. I would have been too young. I was like 10. I didn't see that until I was like maybe 12 when my dad showed it to me the first time. And I didn't get it then either. I liked it. I just didn't. It was later when I think I figured it out. But yeah, I've always thought, like, man, this is just a trippy little thing to do to end your first act. But this movie's being bold, and I like it so far. It's fun, because the other thing is, this is incredibly efficient. Like, they have got us right into the story. We're jumping right on the train. Everything's going down. We do the time travel. And when they come out of it, it's so neat to watch them go over San Francisco. Modern day, what at the time was modern day San Francisco, and they cloak themselves and they go and they land in Golden Gate Park. And I'm like, now I know they're invisible and they dent the ground and all that stuff. People run through that park all the time. Somebody's going
is my only criticism of this film.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, you see people running in the park. It's an open field. I mean, somebody's going to be in that grass. Somebody's going to be throwing frisbee, or somebody's going to be playing soccer. Somebody's going to be doing something. Just like bonk and run into it. It's just like, I don't understand. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that was my only criticism.
They're there for like 2 days, I think, is what I can figure out. You know,
not a short amount of time.
It's not a short amount of time. And long enough that people are going to be like, why does that trash can look like it's just flattened, you know, all of a sudden? And you look, those trash guys, as much as they're talking anyway, you think they're not telling everybody that they just saw a freaking UFO, man?
But probably not, because the trash guy says, like, did you see that? No, and neither did you. So let's so let's go.
But I did think that was funny, that whole, all of that stuff, you know, it takes us back to, they've come out of this like uber clean future where everything is so efficient, right? And it's perfect, to this very dirty 19 every day we live in, right? And you look at it and you're like, God, wow, we've come a long way.
Yes, yeah. It's the, whenever sit there's like, how do the, like, as they're walking around downtown San Francisco, like, how do these people make it out of the 20th century alive? And then Kirk almost gets run over by the taxi. Yes. And the best line, he's like, oh, yeah, the way you're dumbass. Like, well, double dumbass on you.
Yes. No, I love all the excuse to do the profanity now is fun because they've dropped a damn, you know, here and there and stuff like that. But now they're going to let them cut loose a little bit in this one. And I felt like, and I heard somewhere before, I read somewhere that Nimoy was like, I felt like we needed to let some, particularly Kurt, do that so that you could show how he could really fit in any time period. That he may have been the biggest chameleon of everyone because he slips so easily into it. And as he said, I just let Bill be Bill, you know, and he just ran with it and he knew what to do. And, but it, I mean, it's fun. It's fun to watch them do the challenges of 1986. Like they're trying to figure out where to go. They try to get on the bus. They don't have any. They don't have money.
What is Captain? What does exact change mean?
Yeah, yes, he goes and he pawns his glasses, right? And he drops a line in there about like, yeah, there'll be a gift again too. That's the perfect thing. I'm like, well, will they? Will you get them back again? And
that is a paradox. Yeah, no, that is an interest. There's one of two paradoxes in there. One we'll talk about in a second, but the glasses, like he gets the glasses, but he brings them back. If he never came back, he never gets the glasses. Like it's a circular paradox. There's like, huh? So who made the glasses? Like that's the real question. Is
right. You know, I mean, they're, when they, yeah, they're already 100 years old.
Exactly at that point. Yeah, he's like, if the lens cracked, I'll give you $100. And Kirk's like, is that a lot?
Which I mean, I actually looked it up. Like $100 in 1986 is like 400 and change today, which is. All right.
It's not bad, but you also have to split it among
everybody. You got to split it among like six to eight people, but you can make it work. You know, if you're there for a short time, not a long time. So you can make that work if you have to. And I love how he's doing it. Don't splurge. You know, they're just kind of laying it all out.
Yeah.
And, but again, it's part of that fun stuff. And then, you know, Spock has already, they've already had to do the whole, hey, nobody's ever seen an ET before. So he puts on the headband and he does look like something straight out of like Berkeley. You know, it's like, man, this is, and all I can think is Nimoy's like, look, I just want to be comfortable on this shoot. So I'm just going to wear this robe the whole time. And it's very fun.
Each group's mission is just so good and so tailored to them.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, each one of them is so fun. Some you get to see less of, but one of the groups you really get to see a lot of is Scotty and McCoy.
Yes.
And that's a dynamic you really never saw a lot of in the original series or the movies, but wow, what a pairing.
Yeah, let's talk about this. So everybody's got a mission. So the problems are this. We've got to figure out how to make a tank out of the cargo bay of the Klingon ship. Well, Scotty says, yeah, we do this. We just got to put some walls up and no problem. We'll transport them in. But the problem is the crystals in the engine are dead. We don't have anything to recharge them with here, so we got to figure that out. So Spock's like, well, you know, we could steal some you know, nuclear power off of a submarine or a naval vessel, which, by the way, a fun fact, the USS Lexington once pulled up and like provided power for like a month to a city that like the power grid went down just off of their diesel engines just running in the harbor. So that's a real thing. They actually got that out of history. But and being a Navy kid, my dad was in the Navy, so he always talked about like the fact that the power of those, he said it was like a power plant on the water. He said we could have powered cities if we had to, even with the diesel engines and the nuclear ones in particular. So I like that. So we got to go solve that. So Uhura Chekov, you go work on the power problem. Spock and I will work on some getting some whales. And okay, Scotty, you and McCoy have got to go figure out how we're going to build a tank out of this thing. And let's talk about each of the missions because the tank one is the best one. They go like the Plexiglass King of San Francisco or whatever. And I love how the whole back and forth where they do the tour of the plant. They have to set up all this stuff and McCoy's being his little envoy and they have to go through all the things. And some of the best comedy in it though, for me is when James Doohan is trying to use that old Mac computer and he keeps picking up that old mouse and talking to it. And then he just cracks his knuckles. And
oh yeah. He picks up the mouse like, hello, computer.
Yes. Yes. But what they're looking for is this piece of technology from Star Trek called transparent aluminum, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, really thin, really strong, you know, it could be a glass tank, right? Well, But to do, they don't have that there. So what do you got to have? And I love how they give the guy a problem that he can immediately solve. So it's not some rube that they're getting one over. This is a top flight engineer in his field who says, oh yeah, 6-inch plexiglass. We got it. You know, keep it in stock even. How much of it do you need? And then they barter with him over this thing. And the whole bit, and I wonder if this was your other paradox, is that they go like, if we give him that, we're good. Well, how do you know he didn't invent it? And to me, I'm like, okay, no, wait a minute. You guys have Google phones. Y'all want to know that. Y'all be like, no, wait a minute. It was probably his grandson, but so what? We'll give him a 200-year head start.
Yeah, no, that was the other paradox I was telling you about is the transparent aluminum. It's like, what if they never went back in time? How would that have gotten invented? You know, which interestingly enough, transparent aluminum, a real thing, was invented in 2009.
Wildly enough, yeah. So I'd look that up too. But here's what I thought about. This is how I solved that in my own head. I'm like, well, by giving him that, they have now guaranteed that it will be invented and that they will have access to it to go back to get it. So, maybe they just changed the timeline and who gets rich from it, but whatever.
And that's the other good thing about that is McCoy and Scotty, they are already seeing about money and stuff like that and how like wealth drives everything. And so they're saying, it's like, here's the barter right here. Here's the ticket, you know, so what's it worth to you? He's like, oh, it's going to take months to figure out the
years
even. And then McCoy's like, well, this will make you richer beyond the dreams of avarice. And he says, what do you want? And he's like, stock. And that's what they says, yeah, let's give him the formula.
Exactly. Oh,
it's so good. That was a great mission right there.
I love that. We didn't talk about Sulu. Sulu's got to go procure a helicopter.
His is the shortest mission of all.
But I love it. I had always misremembered, like, he goes and steals this from the army, but no, he just goes to like a chopper place that's doing tours or whatever.
They're doing repairs.
They're working on like Blue Thunder's chaser, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. And he's just having this convo with this guy. And I love how it shows you how smooth, you know, Sulu is. He's like, a little bit in my academy days. I'm like, he's flown stuff this dude has never even seen.
Oh yeah.
But I love how it gives me this neat smile to think like the physics of avionics are still true 300 years in the future, you know, or 500 years in the future, you know, because knowing how to fly and how to operate starts with some basic understandings anyway. And then you just translate it to the next level. And I love how he's able to, we don't even know how he gets the thing. He must just impress the guy enough to let him take it for a spin or something. And I love that little, he gets the shortest one, but it is it is neat to watch him sort of get to work solo a little bit. And I feel like they're teasing something that we're going to see in futures is like, he's ready to run his own ship and everything like that. And maybe it's time to start letting him make his own decisions stuff. Cause he clearly can.
Yeah, no, we'll definitely see him as captain soon. His was the shortest, but it was definitely interesting. The Uhura Chekhov one, interesting and also very just a reminder of the year you're in. I mean, the Soviet Union is still around, and the first thing you see is when Chekhov is walking around and he asks the cop, and he's asking in his Russian accent, he's like, how do we get to Alameda? It's where they keep the nuclear vessels. And the cop's like, oh, are you a spy? I mean, he's just looking at him.
It's more just looking at him like, what kind of psycho is this in front of me? He's just like nonplussed by it at all. Yeah. Though they have the funniest bit of it that gets coupled on with what happens to the hospital later. But they have the funniest part where they find the place. They're going to sneak aboard. They're going to steal the photons, you know, whatever. And it's going to be good to go. They've got the little hairdryer more or less to do it with.
Yeah.
And theirs gets interrupted though, because we go to Spock and Kirk, who go to the Scripps Institute, cause they're looking for whales, and they're going, how do we find some whales? And Spock's being all logical about it. And Kirk just looks at the advertisement and goes, maybe we'll just go and grab George and Gracie. And they go on the tour, but this is for the audience. All right, because we need to get the audience on board with this. So how do we do that without beating them over the head? You take them on the simple tour and you give what may be the most impassioned tour guide of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Catherine Hicks is Dr. Taylor here. Now, Catherine Hicks had a hell of a 1986, a lot of time travel in her life. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie called Peggy Sue Got Married.
Yes.
Came out a month before this. It's another time travel story. So, and then 2 years later, she would be the mom in Child's Play. And then Seventh Heaven would happen. And, you know, her life is never the same. And she's had a great career and retired, and more power to her. But her presence on this, I miss movies, Nate, where we had adult characters come in and it didn't still look like people out of a fashion magazine. She looks like a science professor. She, in fact, looked a lot like a biology professor I had in college.
And it was very real. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've heard people say like, oh, there's no way that person would ever be given the tour. I'm like, bro, have you ever worked for a nonprofit?
Like, no, that is absolutely. Yeah, yes. Trust me, as somebody who is a director of a nonprofit, me, it's those tours are the ones you love the most. I mean, it's what so last month I went on the Star Trek Experience tour at Ticonderoga, and the guy who gave us the tour was the guy who owns the place, who built the place. We got the tour by the guy. So yes, that happens. That absolutely happens. They love to get in there as like, oh, I've got some time. You know, I think I'll go give a tour. Like they really... really good. So yes, that's a very real thing. And I think her character is, I think, related to a lot of the non-Trek people because she's not this bombshell. She's not this beauty. She's not this well-known actress. She's just person from the time, from 1986. And she could be anybody that's sitting in the movie theater.
Yeah, she's your next door neighbor. That's why
she was so relatable. Yeah. Which a way smarter casting than who they were very much considering. They wanted Eddie Murphy as the biologist. And I have no idea how that would have worked. That would have been too much, I think.
Murphy's a big Trekkie. He will admit that. He loves this stuff. He passed on it because he didn't feel like they were really leaning into what he could do, you know, and because, and I'll say now it would have been, it wouldn't have worked because Eddie Murphy has to be the comedy star. You know, when he pairs up with people, the best pairings are you put him with somebody who can play the straight, right? Yeah. Arsenio Hall played the straight in Coming to America. Dan Aykroyd, very funny man, played the straight in Trading Places. It's really why that movie works.
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy is best when he's playing the straight. Judge Reinhold's very funny, but he played the straight, kind of the bumbling straight in Beverly Hills Cop. You know, like you play him against the straight and nobody else is playing straight at that point. So that character had to be the straight for everybody else's, you know, comedy, and it wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work. If you got to think of the time period, this is at like peak Eddie Murphy right here. This is right after Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah, which was all a that mega success. Hit.
And he's getting ready to do Golden Child. I mean, this is, it would have been too much. I think it would have been too overshadowing what Trek was trying to do with this film. And I'm glad they didn't do it. I mean, I'm really glad they didn't do that. So, Catherine Hicks, her character, very real. Very personable. And then you see what happens next when Spock goes missing from the tour.
Yes. No, I love that. She's giving this great impassioned speech, really informing the audience. It's a big data dump on whaling and it's what we need to know. And Kirk's sitting there feeding her like, yeah, boy, mankind's terrible. She's like, you don't even know. He's like, actually I do, but okay. You know, so he's playing cool. And all of a sudden we're Spock. And I love Shatner's responses when he looks. And he's just, oh God, you didn't jump in the tank with him. And Spock is in there mind melding with this freaking whale. And again, this is a movie that's got a decent budget. It ain't got a huge budget. They throw Leonard Nimoy in a tank with some whales. I'm like, man, that had to be like a highlight. Again, these were whales that had trainers and stuff like that. And these are the kinds of whales that cannot do any real damage to you. They're just huge Labradors at this point.
Yeah.
So they're just having a good time with this. And I love that she just loses her shit watching him swim with the whales and they have to go get him out. And then she's starting, you know, giving him all these like, the hell I did, the hell I did not.
You
know,
it was so funny. He's like, with all due respect, but they are not the hell your whales. Oh, I suppose they told you that. Hell, they did. And
he doesn't know how to use the curse words.
Introducing the colorful metaphors, as he calls them.
Yes, all of those things. But it's what's funny is that they have that back and forth. And of course, Kirk knows what he's doing, but he's like, let me just get him out of there. I promise you're going to hurt. And she's like, get out of this place. She kicks him out, you know, and they have this whole talk and, you know, he's able to tell Kirk like, hey, I think they know what we're here for. They understood what we said. And that's what to me was kind of cool is like the idea. And this, I feel like this goes back to like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of stuff. It's like sea life is actually not from this planet. And I didn't know about that until later, you know, years later, but now I'm sitting there going like, man, it would have been like maybe on the nose, but if they could have just worked in a little thanks for all the fish in the background, I would have had it, or like a sign that said that. That would have been funny.
Yeah, all that squeaking. We're actually just trying to warn you of what's coming on. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh man,
I love the idea that sea life, at least whale sea or mammal sea life, isn't from this planet.
Yeah.
You know, or at least has origins elsewhere too, which is kind of neat.
Yes. And they were, as we heard early in the movie, it's like, you know, when they were saying, well, can we find them anywhere else? And Spock was like, negative. They are indicative of Earth of the past, only to Earth. That's it. There's no other planets that they knew of that had them. And so, yeah, that whole scene was great. And thus begins the quest. And then the second encounter they have with the doctor is, I think, even funnier.
Oh, yeah. When she picks him up in the car and the truck and that, give him and the
that
ride.
Was, almost completely ad-lib too. That was all. It was so good. That may be one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie.
Oh, it's perfect. Yeah, Kirk's like, he did a little too much LDS. You know, he's trying to say he's on LSD, and she's like, okay, man, whatever. But she is playing her character out, which is sucker for hard luck cases, you know. And there's, and you can tell she tells, like, there's something earnest about these guys. They're weird, but they seem kind of harmless, you know. And also, I know how to take care of myself. So, I mean, she says about having a tire iron nearby, and, you know, they're like, no problems. And so they're doing this thing. And when he drops on her that he knows the whales are pregnant, she hits the brakes. That was awesome.
Oh, yeah. She's like, how the hell do you know that? It's, and then Kirk goes into straight on Kirk, a Kirk we haven't seen in a while. Mm-hmm. It's the flirtatious Kirk, where he says, you know, I assure you we're not with the military, but we can talk about this. How about over dinner? Yeah. And she's like, do you guys like Italian? And then that scene, we're like, yes, no, yes, yes. I love Italian. And so do you.
Yes. No, you're right, though. It's Kirk being in command again. Yes. And you realize, like, there's a reason he sits in that chair. He doesn't do it the way everybody else does it. Maybe it's a little off kilter, but the results speak for themselves. Just let the man cook, let him work, you know? And, you know, she drops Spock off in the park, obviously, and he's just going to wander around. It's his way, which I thought was hilarious. And then they're going to go off to dinner. But while that's happening, we've got to check back in with Uhura and Chekhov, because Sulu's dropping the tank walls down. We've already solved all that. Scotty's getting that squared away. They're in there stealing the power out of the reactor. And obviously everybody operating equipment on there is going to realize there's a problem. Like, this is, you can't just drain
massive
the
power drain while you're sitting in dock. You're like, and it's all right.
Some of the best comedy is when the CIA arrests Chekhov. Uhura gets beamed up with the stuff and he gets arrested. He can't stun anybody. You know, and they're going through this whole back and forth. And I just love that interrogation scene, man. It's just great comedy.
Oh yeah. And it's not a, I don't even want to call it a criticism, but there's like one other thing I had with the movie is like, maybe they should have done their research a little bit. So when it was Uhura and Chekhov down there and they're like, okay, we can beam one of you back. Chekhov should have said, it's gotta be me. Like, this is, we're in the height of the Cold War and the Soviet Union and the United States do not like each other. If I'm the one that's caught, it's real bad business.
Well, let me defend it real quick. That it had been so long since that conflict had registered on anybody's radar.
That's true.
You wonder if he even had ever heard it growing up, you know, because he's grown up in a time when we've had intergalactic relations, right? I mean, for all we know, he wasn't even born on Earth, you know? And so the Russians and the Americans have been friends his whole life and probably two generations before. So I hear you, but on the other hand, it's also kind of a neat statement to say at some point we're going to get to a place in life where a Russian won't even think this is a bad idea, other than just getting caught. Like, they know they're committing theft. Like, they're going to get caught for that. But the fact that he's Russian doesn't seem to register with him. And the fact that the two CIA guys can't figure out what the hell's going on. It's like, he must be crazy. Maybe they use the R word, which I know we don't want to say, but like, this guy's just, he's out of his mind, you know? And I love that he picks up the thing and he's going to try to stun him and it doesn't work because, you know, radiation or bad Klingon technology, whatever. But when he fell off that boat, I've told parts of this story through podcasts through the years. I am a survivor of a major head injury when I was a kid, and it's not all that different than Chekhov's, the epidermal hematoma, all that stuff. and that, you know, all the stuff that they were going to do to him in the hospital, I've had done to me. I wish I'd had McCoy around back then, because it would have been a lot simpler, I'll tell you. But I remember seeing that, and that happened a year before I saw this movie. So you talk about something that just really like, boom, and, you know, little Jay's face right here, man. That I've always resonated with this movie specifically because of that sequence where Chekhov gets hurt, he gets taken to the hospital, and they don't think he's going to make it. Because in 1986, a major head injury like that, you weren't even 50-50. You were more
That's true.
Yeah.
That's very, very true.
Yeah. And it also gave the crew time to bring back the moment. We've done all the funny now. Now we got to bring everybody back to be a little bit more serious. We've got a real problem. You know, we can't leave somebody here for a myriad of reasons, but most off, we just went across the galaxy to save one guy. We're definitely not leaving this guy behind.
Oh,
so we already know they got to go get him. And the way that they go and do that, because they bring Dr. Taylor in on it, because they're at dinner. We got to go back to Kirk and her, the dinner.
All right.
It's one of the neatest little pieces of Shatner acting when they pour him that Michelob and he takes a swig of it. And he's like, okay. he's like, you can tell he's never had anything like that in his life.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And he's had alcohol. They have alcohol and, you know, Rummy the Nail, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is horse piss.
He's like, Yeah. So a little interesting thing about that scene is the restaurant where they filmed it at didn't have a pizza oven to cook a pizza. So they built a pizza oven for the restaurant and gave it to them so they could have a pizza there. It's a
that restaurant.
Yeah, that was the reason they have that.
And, that's a very like Michael Mann thing to do. It's just, well, you don't have one. Well, I'll just build one for you. build it in the budget. Yeah.
And then the big thing, that's the reveal. Like Kirk's like, okay, you know, here's the truth. Like the honest to God truth, where I'm from, what I'm doing. And she's like, yeah, I don't believe any of that. That's ridiculous. And then she admits, oh, they're shipping out tomorrow. He's like, we gotta go right now. And so thus begins the speed up. They have to, like, the whole mission is quickly sped up. They have to go, and they have to go now.
Exactly. And that's when they get the word Chekhov's in trouble. You know, we got problems. So they're recharging the crystals. That's gonna happen. We got the things in. You know, we're going to get the whales, but we got to get our guy back. So she's like, well, I know how to get you to the hospital, you know, and they score her, McCoy and Kirk go on the little rescue mission in their scrubs. And you talk about some great hospital comedy, you know, take one and call me tomorrow. Grows a lady a new kidney.
That was hilarious. Great. He's like, what is this, the Dark Ages? Like,
yes, and it is. It is in medicine. To him, all of this is just, oh, what are we doing? You know, and I love how it just, he's just so frustrated by it all. And I'm like, dude, you're 400 years in the past. Like, give him a break. Like, they'll eventually figure it out, you know. But
oh, and the banner he has that McCoy has with the surgeon, and they're going back and forth and back and forth. And then all of a sudden McCoy's like, my God, man, drilling holes in his head is not the problem. You have to fix the artery. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
but in 1986, you drilled holes in people's head to fix the artery. As someone who's had that done, that was the way you got that done. So it's, but again, I'm watching that, and I remember it as vivid as anything. I'm watching that, and I remember my mother getting a little teared up at that, you know, and I remember looking at her going like, that would have been nice, right? And she just laughed about it, because we both like found the humor, and like, he just puts the little thing on his head and 20 seconds later, it's good to go, you know? Yeah. And I love though that when they have to wheel him out, he keeps trying to look up, and they keep putting his head back down. Like, nope, not right now. Not now. So, you know, because he's still groggy from it. He's not all there, you know, but they get him out of the hospital, and it's time to go and, you know, give me the frequency on the tags and the whales. We're going to go get them. I promise you it's going to be good. I can't thank you enough. Yada, yada. And I love how Dr. Taylor surprises him and jumps in his arms. And I'm like, you know, she doesn't have a family, you know, she never talks about him. We don't know anything, but there are newspaper articles for at least 2 weeks going, Scripps Institute biologist goes off on her boss and disappears. Yeah. She is an unsolved mystery in 1986, Nate. Like, yeah. There's an episode dedicated to Gillian Tate.
It has to be. Yeah, that's exactly. Where did she go? Slap. And I'm sure her boss probably was like the number one suspect.
I know that poor guy probably got railroaded by the cops. You think, like, when she got to the space, she's like, let me find out what happened to everybody.
For me, if I were in her position, that would be the first thing I would do. I was like, I got to find out what happened to everybody I knew. They get on there. And essentially the slap that she gave him was actually a real slap in real life. And the other guy, her boss, the guy who played him, didn't know that was coming. And so the look, you see the stunned look, that's like an actual, like, oh, wow.
Yep. The thing I read is Nimoy said, he doesn't know it's coming. It'll be great. Just do it. And so she just hauled off and nailed him. But I mean, those are the best reactions. It's like when they dropped Alan Rickman on the out of the window, they told him we're going to do it on three, and they dropped him on two. The look on his face is priceless. I mean, it's a meme now. So.
I love it.
Yeah, apparently he forgave John McTiernan for that.
He was not happy for a while. Pleased with that. So, not a while.
But again, it's a great moment. She gets on the ship with him. They go, they get the whales, or they find the whales. But first, we got to take a little trip. And the whales have already made it far enough north that we've got this, whaling boat out there, full harpoon and everything. And it's one of the coolest shots ever. It's a great effect shot.
Man.
When they block the harpoon and decloak, that's one of them. And those guys are turning that boat for everything it'll do.
That was my absolute favorite scene of that movie. Oh, as a kid, I watched that. I was like, it's awesome because you're sitting there, you're really worried as a kid, and you're just like, no, don't hurt the whales. All of a sudden, bonk, and the thing goes in the water and it decloaks. Oh my God, I love that so much. Gives me goosebumps.
I'd like to take this moment to tell everyone, though, we're talking about a Star Trek movie where not a single shot is fired the entire film.
Technically, that's correct, except for once where when they're in the hospital, Kirk fires his phaser to melt the lock on the door to lock the modern day surgeons. But that's it. Like,
two movies where it's a lot of ship to ship battle, and in this one, they specifically said, we're not arming the weapons on the ships. We're not firing upon this. That's not how it, because every problem can't be. And I remember reading Harv Bennett's take on this. He said, I felt strongly, and so did Leonard, that we needed to show that you don't have to solve every problem with the laser gun. Sometimes you have to solve it with know-how and diplomacy and science, because that's Starfleet and that's Star Trek.
Exactly. I mean, you saw that time and time and time again in the original series. You'll see that time and time and time again in Next Gen, that there are ways that you don't have to fight your way out. There are ways that, diplomacy and negotiation and understanding, that is at the very core of Star Trek. And I love that they didn't have to fire any shots at this. I absolutely love it.
No, it brings home the message again that not everything is done through violence, return for violence. Mm-hmm. You can do things through thinking through the problem, and approaching it differently. And we have to give them the conceit that they can time travel and all those kind of things. But, we may not can do that now, but you can move time around if you need to solve a problem. We do it every day, just to make things work. So I love that, though. And that, they go back. We don't get the Pink Floyd return. We're just going to do the quick solo and comfortably numb and come back. We drop the whales off and we're waiting on them. And what's fun is when the probe leaves, the sun comes out, everybody starts cheering. And what looks like very candid moments in the water tank where they're desperately trying to throw Leonard Nimoy in the water and he is not having it. And they do it anyway. And I'm like, I can only imagine the conversation from Shatner was like, no, if my toupee can handle it, so can yours.
He was not having that at all. I'm sure that water wasn't exactly warm either.
Or it was like super warm.
Or maybe it might have been super warm. Yeah. Well, that's true. Yeah. They were probably filming it in summertime.
Probably in a tank too. And it's probably kind of gross and, all the other things. I love that we got to that point and we fixed the big problem, but we still have the lingering issue of, we came back to face the music and now they have to face the music. Right. And I love how Spock stands with his shipmates, he's not accused, but no, I stand with him. So, okay then. And everybody's pardoned except Kirk. You know, because you disobeyed the direct order of the Excelsior captain. By the way, where are those bolts? We need those back.
Yeah. Thanks for, you know, setting us back for indefinite with the transwarp drive thing.
I think we've established money doesn't exist in the 23rd century, so at least it wasn't a blown budget item. But
right.
But,
yeah, that's true.
But still, it's you know, a thing. But it's one of the great uses of the Star Trek theme, because everything's very somber here at this moment. And then when they demote him from admiral to captain and say, you're going to have to go prove yourself on a ship, because we can't trust you in the office anymore. And they work that theme underneath it. It's like this little triumphant return. And the look, again, Shatner in this movie really does a lot with the face. And that face of like, oh, I'm home. I'm back where I belong. You know,
back where it belongs.
It's like, and I mean, I think we've all been there. Like, you're in a job or whatever, and then you end up, you know, going to do a different job, and you realize very quickly, like, oh, this is so much more what I should be doing, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. When you're around the right group of people, it just makes a difference.
Yeah. I can relate to that a little bit. I remember my first museum job was a nonprofit at the University of South Carolina. And I found I loved working in nonprofits. Very, very much I love working in nonprofits. And then my next museum job was a for-profit museum. And at first I was like, let's step up. I'm excited. But there was a lot about it that was very, very difficult. And so when I came to the job I'm at now, which is a nonprofit, it was the same feeling like, I'm home. I get this. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what I meant to do, kind of thing. And I'm sure that was the same thing. He's like, all right, I had my time as admiral. That didn't work out so well. But now I'm back home. So yeah, it was fabulous. The one thing that I thought was also emotional after the trial was when Spock's dad, Sarek, comes up to him and he says, as I recall, I disapprove of your entrance into Starfleet. And he's like, perhaps I had misjudged that. And that is huge for Spock. I mean, absolutely huge. And then when Spock says, when Sarek says, do you have a message for your mother? He says, yes, tell her I feel fine. And going back to the test, like, how do you feel? Yeah. And he has no answer. And now I feel fine. Oh, that was just that very short dialogue had so much emotional impact.
No, it's perfect. It's a way to wrap up again this adventure, which has been stringing out for three movies. So they're clearly making it. We're going to end this train of thought now and you know, of course they were thinking, are we going to do any more? At this point, the cast had gotten to a point where, like, do we really need to do this again? Like, you know, they hadn't really decided if there was going to be any more when they were doing this. So if this was it, well, let's make sure we tie it all up and we send them off into space, you know, happy go lucky. And the only thing is like, Gillian Taylor and Kirk have this whole like cute little thing, like, well, I don't have your number, all this stuff. And she's like, I'll find you. And I'm like, but you never do. And I'm you know what happened, man? I'm sure like her 20th century ways, some other science dude saw her and that was it.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's like, oh, you're speaking my language. Yeah. This guy might have brought me in forward in time, but you're speaking my language. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And I'm like, well, good for her. But, you know, I'm glad they gave her a job. And again, she's got the most important job in the galaxy now. None of you know anything about these creatures. So let me tell you what they're really like versus what your book, you know, cartridge says about them. And so I do think that's kind of neat. And that we get everybody wrapped up. And when they're going on a little cruiser, you know, I'll take whatever we get, you know, and of course Sulu's rooting for Excelsior. And Scotty's like, well, why would you want that piece of garbage? You know, so they're having a good time with that. And I want to ask you though, when they come over the horizon, again, we get the theme and it's the new Enterprise, you know, it's just the Avert, like, how fast can they build these ships? Was that always the plan? Because the old one was getting docked. We knew that.
I don't think so. It wasn't always going to be the Enterprise. And honestly, it was probably very likely. I mean, you got to think at this point, the Constitution class ship was still the type of ship that they preferred. It was the best type of ship in the entire fleet. And the Excelsior had just gotten built. I mean, the Excelsior was still very, very, very new. Mm-hmm. So that was the only one of its kind. So the Constitution class, the Excelsior is eventually going to replace the Constitution class. So this was just another Constitution class ship that they were in the process of building. As we'll see at the beginning of Star Trek V, it was really not complete yet. And so it was a very, very new ship. And then once they came and said, you know what, you know, the Enterprise has been done. They probably had another name, my speculation, they probably had another name for the ship, but like, you know what? The Enterprise is done. You know, we're just going to call this Enterprise and the 1701A. And that's what they gave the name. It wasn't always intended to be that, because I mean, you got to think, when you're looking at the time frame for this, we're talking, it's just a matter of days. And so that's when they, like, after the trial, like, you know, Kirk's a captain again. And we don't know how much time it was between the trial and when they go to their next calling, their next ship. And so at that point, that could have been plenty of time to slap the new name on there and get the name throughout the ship and everything like that.
I like your explanation of it, is that it was just another Constitution class ship. And they decided, somebody in the office was like, you know what? Let's throw the old guy a bone. He did just save us all again.
Yeah.
So, you know, we know we're throwing him one anyway, but let's give him one more. We'll do it for the rest of them too, because, you know, they deserve this as much as anybody. And And again, with the idea of, if they never made another Star Trek movie of this cast or whatever, this is a heck of a send off for the group.
It is,
you know,
it's right out into the sunset. Let's see what she's got. Yeah,
exactly. And they hit it and boom, they're gone. And, you know, we can talk about it next time. Should it have been, you know, the last voyage of this group before we hand it off to the new one? Because like you said, the Next Generation TV show is about to start. So we're going to start leaning into some new people. Eventually they're going to get movies, all that stuff, but they're going to, I don't know that people realized how popular Star Trek The Next Generation was going to be when it came out. And it took it a minute to catch its legs, which is, you know, boy, talk about a different time in television when you let a series kind of find itself and then take off. But man, boy, when it did that, it just took over the Star Trek universe. It's
with the season one, some of the cast will say that, like, for the first several months they were living out of their suitcases. They had no idea if this is going to last or what. It was, you know, wait and see. And so there was, you had two more original cast movies before the Next Gen movies. And I remember thinking, like, when Star Trek V came out as a kid, I was like, who is it going to be, Next Gen? But it was still too soon. Next Gen had only been around like two seasons at that point. But then when Star Trek VI came out at that point, because that's like 1992, and people are like, all right, we need some Next Gen stuff at this point. Because that, by that, between 5 and 6, Next Gen had really taken off. And that's when people were clamoring for those Next Gen movies.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And we'll get to those in a little bit, because as we know, there are two more of the original cast movies, but that's another day. We're here at the end of the podcast, and it's time to give final thoughts and popcorn ratings. So, Nate, what are yours for Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home?
Oh, I give the highest popcorn rating for this one that we can have. And in the pantheon of Trek films, this is my 1, 2, 3. It's tied for fourth. It's my fourth favorite. So this is, we've covered my second favorite, which is Star Trek II. We haven't gotten to my first and third yet, or the one that's tied for fourth yet. We'll get to those, but this is definitely up there in my, it's in my top four. It's tied for fourth. I absolutely love this film. This is the film that you can sit down with people who don't like Star Trek and they like it. To this day, people I know, when I say, oh, you know, I love watching Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, it's like, is that the one with the whales? The one with the whales is how it's always remembered. And even my fiance is like, I saw Star Trek films. What was the one with the whales? It's always the one with the whales. And I think that has resonated, the Save the Whale movement, the Challenger. It's resonated throughout time. So absolutely one of my favorite Trek films. They did a nice pivot from the darkness of the previous two.
Now, I agree with you 100% on that. And it's a hard thing to take a turn like that and go from very serious, very dramatic stuff to something lighter and not lose anything in it and still tell a good story. And I think you've hit something about this that also shares something in common with another part four out there. I tell people all the time, if you've never seen a Friday the 13th movie, just watch part four. It's called The Final Chapter. Yeah, I assure you that's not.
I agree.
But the first 10 minutes of it tell you everything you need to know. And then the next 80 minutes are everything the best of that series could ever be.
And totally agreed.
Yeah. And this one is, if you don't like Star Trek movies, well, watch the fourth one and it'll probably lead you. It's the gateway drug into watching the other one. And really what you do is then go watch 2 and 3 and you'll want to watch 4 again, because they slide in together. And then if you want to dabble in some other stuff, then we can start talking. But 4 is the entry point for a lot of people. And we can't downplay enough how hard that is to do, because we talked about it in the intro. How do you play to your core audience and play to the broad audience at the same time? And the way you do it is you give them a tightly contained story that's well executed, well acted, has a good balance of comedy and action, and also doesn't ask them to make difficult decisions. Everyone can agree, extinct whales, bad idea. All right. Yeah. And there's consequences for these things. Make a difference now while we still can in the real world here, and tell everybody why. Because someday, you never know, it'll come back to haunt us, you know. And to do that without beating people over the head is a really, really deft screenplay and good direction by Nimoy and everybody involved. So extra large popcorn for me as well. In the original set, and I split the Star Trek films up into the three bunches. I don't think in my head, I can't rank them all together because they're such different animals. The Next Generation right. films, and then the new films, the J.J. Abrams films. This of these six that we're doing here, this is my second in that grouping. And I've come to appreciate motion picture a lot more for what it is, but it still has flaws. And things, I think three is a lot better than people give it credit for. And they make fun of the stuff in it that's actually really works if you'll go with it dramatically. But two and four are the most watchable, accessible things for someone who's just a movie fan of the Star Trek movies or just a movie fan anyway. And again, the fact that they're able to pull that off four chapters in, 20 years in to the series, and still come up with something this fresh and this fun is a testament to everybody involved. So yeah, it's an extra large popcorn, and it's been a long time since I've gone to the final frontier, Nate, with part five. Undiscovered Country is another story. That's one I will spool up from time to time. We'll talk about that when we get to it, but the next chapter is going to be a different turn for us. And
we went from dark to comedy, and now we've got one that's trying to do both and doesn't really
It doesn't have a great reputation. And like I said, it's been a few years since I revisited it. It feels like that album that the bands you really love put out, and you go, I don't know if I love this or not anymore.
Yeah,
I appreciate it, guys, but I don't know if I feel this one, you know. And so it's maybe I'll try to come up with a direct representation of that from some popular band here by the next time we do it. But as always, Nate, great talking Star Trek with you here on the show. Folks, thanks for joining us on this next leg of our Star Trek cinematic journey. You can find us on social media at Filmstrip Pod. Please subscribe, tell other people about the show, and share it on your socials as well. We're everywhere podcasts are found: Apple, Google, Spotify, not Google anymore. That's now been rolled into YouTube Music, I think, but we're there. iHeartRadio, again, Spotify, all those. Leave us a rating because it helps other people find the show as well. We are 14 years into the film strip journey here and rolling headlong into 400 episodes. And if we time it out right, we may hit 400 before the end of 2024 here, which would be quite a feat to keep going this long. And we do it because we enjoy talking movies with each other and enjoy interacting with you all. So thank you again for your support. Until next time, thank you for listening, Film Strip.
Thank you for listening to Film Strip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.